Okay, good morning, everybody. My name's Eamon Kelly.
My name is William Derry.
And today we're going to discuss the book by Daryl Huff called How to Lie with Statistics. And so so first impressions of the book, Will, what did you think of it?
So far it's been good. I think that the introduction set up the format in which you wanted to do the book. I like how the use of illustration is used throughout the book. And I think that he pulls from so many different other statisticians to form his opinion, which is also nice.
Yeah, I feel that the illustrations like totally help out, even though this is sort of like the most basic book that you can understand with language statistics. I mean, there's this book called What If? I can't remember the author's name, but he's basically explaining, you know, situations using physics, comics, and everything. And I really think that this is also, it's very similar, like using different examples, using these illustrations, like, for example, this guy is sitting down on a bench. You know, just basic illustrations like that. And now, the first thing that I like to... The first sentence in the introduction is what I actually like about this. There's a mighty lot of crime out there. And what he means by crime is lying with statistics, because people don't really understand that they're lying. And I also like the quote, "It misleads, yet it cannot be pinned on you." So you don't exactly know that they're lying, right?
Right.
Yeah. I remember throughout the entire first three chapters, the word that they use a lot is the word average, and that can be used in so many different ways, especially in this book. For example, you can tell somebody, oh, the average costs of living arrangements is this amount of dollars. And obviously, you can't really tell that's a lie because they're using actual money numbers and, like, the word average, and that can mislead you. And for example, I think at the very beginning of chapter 2, which is on page 27, let me just get to that really quick. You're talking about this one quote. This one quote right here. "More than likely, since we have agreed that..." "Yeah, more than likely, since we have agreed that for the purposes of the moment, you are a bit of a snob. You toss in casually that when telling friends about where you live." And so I think that that's really interesting because you could be lying about where you live. You can be saying the average living person makes around this much money a year. And I think that, that's the most basic lie you can tell someone when you're living. And then just using a combination of mathematical terms, vocabulary like average, and then throwing in some random numbers, I think that's how Trump is very successful, because he keeps throwing in random numbers. Like, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, no, what you just said is exactly right. I think that the quote that you just brought up at the beginning of chapter 2 with unsure about where if people really live in a certain place or they could be lying about it is something he did early on in the book when he talked about the magazine cover of the average Yale man. He talked about the class of 24, and they were basically, he got down to the basis of how many of the actual members did they survey. Did they only survey the top 10%, the working class, or did they survey the people who are as successful or not successful? So I think that what he did also in chapter 2 to begin it was use a broad topic, but then he starts to dissect it as he goes on in the chapter.
I did notice something in that chapter about the Yale man, baby, because I can't really find what chapter is. Sort of, that's like, the average Yale man, class of 24, Time magazine noted once that commenting on something in New York, some makes $25,111 a year. And then the next sentence is, "Well, good for him." And I think that, like, based on my own interpretation, that sounds like the book is tricked itself at first. Because it sounds like, because of course it's a lie, because the book is called How to Lie with Statistics, and that's obviously a lie based on the background information. And the next sentence is, "Well, that's good for him." And it's saying that something simple as that can trick you very easily. And then it goes into, like, so many pages of, like, about the history of how much of the average person Yale man makes. And I think that, like, it just shows you how very easily you can be tricked. And where I'm going with this is that, like, the entire structure of the book... I'm not really sure if I'm a fan of the way this book is structured, because it's not really written in the form of a guide, but it still writes ways and examples on lying. So it has this, but it has historical background of like why people choose to lie. But I'm not sure if that's my main problem with this book, because like the book is called How to Lie with Statistics, yet I expected this to be written in the form of a guide or like a sort of how-to book rather than just living stories. I mean, like, that's sort of my main problem with this book, because, you know, I figured that it should tell you any unit, not just tell you, while this is interesting information, I'm not sure it's the right kind of information, just to show you how people lie, but sort of that's just me. I mean, like,
no, I see. I hear what you're saying now. Now that I read more into the title, it is How to Lie with Statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So you think it would be a step-by-step guide on how to lie with statistics.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like with him, he's giving more of the background of it, more of the scientific idea of lying with statistics. Not so much the step-by-step, this is what you do, this is what you do from step 1 to step 20.
Yeah.
This is how you, execute this. So I think that the way the setup could definitely be changed. I do like how he includes pictures every once in a while.
Yeah.
The illustrations.
And now, out of all these four chapters, if you count the introduction, like which example do you think works well the best, or which example do you think that you were most intrigued by?
I think it was... the count 'em. He talked about pulling out a handful of beans and counting those up.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you something on the basis of, if you take them all out and you count, you can find a proportion of how many beans are actually in it without having to actually count every single bean.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's like the saying, don't count your chickens before they hatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think that sort of intrigued you the most?
I think it's because of how simplistic it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was simple, but at the same time it described a larger idea, so I thought that it was really effective.
It's a way of showing you the whole line of statistics thing, it can be really small, as counting beans or just telling you how much it costs you to live in a house or something like that. I think that these illustrations also help with it, because it just shows this picture right here on page 19. The guy says good morning, and the guy that goes says, so they wonder what he means by that. Because now I think these guys could be interested in what these people are saying, and so they might be saying, what does he mean by, don't count your chickens until they hatch? Okay, sorry for that pause. Anyway, so what I was saying about the drawing, the guy says good morning, and then the second guy says, I wonder what he means by this. I think that this is really interesting, because it shows you that you could be tricked to an extreme and then realize that these people are lying to you, and then be superstitious about every single thing you hear in your life. For example, there are three copies of my papers on my desk. He was like, what does he mean by three copies? And you're like, well, there are three copies. What do you mean? I'm like, so you're lying to me using statistics. I'm like, no, there are three. I think that this also is a dangerous book to read, BB, because it can also send you into chaos, not exactly knowing the truth or being told that you're lying when actually they're not. It's just very, very, very confusing. And and this is only the first three chapters. There are still many chapters to dive into. I don't know if you feel the same way.
No, definitely. It can send you on a ride, a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Because at times you're like, well, then you start to contemplate your own life.
Like, what does it mean to live using math knowledge? Yeah.
So then you start asking yourself larger questions than the book is even asking.
Yeah. This book could be... even action. I'm not sure. So far I really enjoyed this book. I'm not really a fan of the structure, but I think it is a very interesting read. I think that I will enjoy this book because looking at myself, I'm not really a book fan. But showing that it takes a topic that I'm not really not the best of in school, and then shows you how you can lie using the math. Now, I think that this is really useful for my life, especially since I won't be going into a math major, but knowing that I'll be using statistics to lie in my life if I have to. So, same for you.
Yeah, definitely.
What are you hoping to major in college?
Probably journalism.
Probably journalism. Do you think that you'll be using that in journalism?
Well, definitely to, I guess, sway my readers at times.
Definitely to sway readers. Over 90% read this journalism project. And
yeah.
Then, I'll probably do the same thing when I'm producing a movie. Actually, you know what? Different movie websites, reviewers like Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb, there's a 6 out of 10 on this movie. There's a 93% of Rotten Tomatoes for for this particular movie, but also they're pretty truthful, which is also pretty deceiving. You know, for example, the movie Pixels got a 16%, and everybody agrees that it's a bad movie. I mean, but like, it's the same thing. You can't really tell if they're lying or not, or they're slightly offbeat. But yeah, I think that like this book is really interesting, and it shows, you know, both sides of the spectrum. You know, like the people giving the lie based on their knowledge, and people receiving the lie and how they take it. And so yeah, I can't wait to see how the, like, you know, the other examples that they give you. And I can't wait to see everybody at our next podcast next week. Once again, I'm Eamon.
Will.
And we will see you next week.
All right, good morning, everybody. My name is Eamon Kelly.
My name is William Derry.
And welcome to our second podcast of Daryl Huff's How to Lie with Statistics. Now, we read chapters 4 through 6 of this, but before we kick into those chapters, I understand that there have been some questions from somebody by the name of Mark Miles, whoever that guy is. And he asked us some questions regarding our last podcast, so before we kick into what we are going to discuss, we're just going to go over some of the questions that he's asking. The first one being, quote, and this is from the introduction, the first sentence, I think, there are 3 kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. Now he's asking how this relates to the introduction. Well, obviously, it's pretty self-explanatory. There are 3 kinds of lies, and for example, the basic kind of lies, which means, you know, I was out going shopping, and you told someone you were supposed to stay home. Damn lies mean, you know, it's your baby. And statistics is obviously the most interesting kind of lie, because they're trying to introduce us through this book that statistics are like the most popular and confusing way of lying. And usually it's supposed to be just lies and damn lies, but by adding the third, which is statistics, it shows us that this is the most complicated yet effective way of lying. Like, if you agree with that.
No, I agree with that. Exactly what you said, that the 3 that you mentioned, the 3 types of lies, damn lies, and statistics are, they set the foundation for the book. So I think that it connects to the introduction because it gives us a brief summary of what the book brings to the table.
Mm-hmm. And now we have this paragraph. So before we discuss, I'm just going to read it to you. Quote, a river cannot, we are told, rise above its source. Well, it can seem to if there's a pumping station concealed somewhere about. It is equally true that the result of a sampling study is no better than the sample it is based on. By the time the data has been filtered through layers of statistical manipulation and reduced to a decimal pointed average, the result being to take on an aura of conviction that a closer look at the sampling would delay. Now, he's asking us to say this in our own words, and I understand that you have your own theory of what it is.
Yeah, my theory is, and you can take it for what it is that the statisticians paint a mirage for us. They may not tell us exactly what the statistics behind it is, but they tell us, you know, what we need to hear, what we need to see. So in my mind, I see a picture, I guess you can imagine a river, and maybe it's not overflow, maybe it doesn't have a pump station, but in our mind, it does. I just think that the statisticians are a bit lazy, so if they were to truly do all the stats behind the, let's say this example, that it would be too much and probably be too hard to explain, so they paint a simple picture for their consumers to understand.
I mean, true. I think I see what you're saying. So, are you guys you're saying that people are using statistics to try to confuse the others, or like just trying to make sure that people understand what they're trying to say without actually having to use stats because you say they're quote lazy. I don't know if you're in Mr. Baird's history class, we were learning about Enron, the company that went bankrupt back in 2001, and they were actually using statistical knowledge to try to maximize profit, but ended up actually creating false information, and everybody got confused, and then went bankrupt, and it laid off 5,000 workers, and that's all based on people lying using statistics. And so even though someone can clearly have their benefits with lying, something can seriously go wrong and mess up the whole company. So that's a good example. All right, so the next one is, what does this quote mean? Hardly anybody is exactly normal in any way. Well, obviously, right off the bat, this is true, because, like, there's no such thing as a normal human being, especially at a school like SLA, for example. There's, like, no such thing as a normal person. And there's no such thing as a normal person in the whole planet, you know. They have their weird talents, they have their personality quirks, they have their pros and their cons. And so, you don't really need to use statistics to back that up. You know, it's just pretty self-explanatory that everybody's not normal in their own way. Everybody has a fantastic talent, everybody has a personality quirk, you know, something. that just makes them human, and human does not equal normal. And then when we see an average reported, what do we see to ask besides what kind of average is being used? Well, I remember in the beginning of chapter 4, it's talking about Peter and Linda's IQ, and it said that Peter's IQ is 98 and Linda is 101, and that the average is 100. And now they're saying that Peter's IQ is supposedly below average, but later in the chapter it explains that it just because you happen to be below 100 does not mean that you're below average. At a certain point, it explains that there's a certain range that's beyond, like, below 98 and above 100. That range is essentially the normal range, is that, and that you kind of need to explain yourself as to what, in actuality, normal is and what kind of average is being used. And you can't really use this one singular number to calculate average because it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there. You can't create an average with just one.
Yeah.
One example.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be more of a larger data sample.
Yeah, and this relates to the chapter 4. You know, to talking about averages and using Peter and like Peter and Linda's IQ as an example. I think that using the term average can be pretty confusing unless you seriously know what you're talking about. You know, say for instance, you know, my average bowling score is 2-something or like 200 or something like that. You wouldn't necessarily think that they score that exact same number all the time. What they're trying to say is that they bowled thousands of times, and when you add them all up and divide it by how many games you played, that's the number, and that's what average means. But people these days are really confused by that term. But still, there is a range. Like, for instance, if I say my average was 280, then the range would be somewhere between a perfect score, which is 300, and, like, 250. That would be the range of average, not just that one number that I just said. Another thing is we mentioned in the last podcast that the pictures are pretty both entertaining and they're very useful to read, not just the graphs, but, like, especially in the beginning of chapter 5, there's a quote that says, I think it's like the bottom paragraph. It says, when numbers in tabular form are taboo and words will not do the work well, as often the cause, there's only one answer left, draw a picture. And at first I was confused because you can't just draw a picture and show everybody. But so you know how we've been saying that using statistics and like fake numbers can essentially fool a human being into thinking that that's true?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I finally understood that using pictures, you know, say for instance, you know, there are people across the world that don't care about reading numbers. They're not a math person. They don't really want to be learning more math. I know I'm one of those people. I would want to see visual representation of what they're talking about. So, you know, like, you know those old cartoon shows when they're trying to, you know, when these silly cartoon characters are trying to explain why things are going wrong and they have this fake graph and everything and a big shocky line down the center. That you know, they're essentially trying to make stuff up by using a drawing to further prove that they're smart people, but they're actually trying to fool the humans by using these pictures. And there's a lot of graphs in these next two chapters. For example, the one on page 62 and 63 of just the guy's face. I can't quite remember what exactly they're talking about, but it's in terms of currency. I can see that the explanatory value is numbers or something, or letters, and the response variable is currency, I think. But yeah, but going back on topic, I think that using pictures in a combination with fake numbers and fake averages, like we already said, can be a useful tool to fool a human being into thinking that what they're saying is actually true based on the supposed evidence that they have. If that makes sense to you.
No, it makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on these last past two chapters that we just read? So like, any opinions or, like,
well, I think the past chapters have been informational. With the G-Wiz graph, I know...
The G-Wiz graph.
Yeah.
Like, what's that? So, like, everybody can understand.
The GWIS graph is... That is... I'm in trouble finding
Well, first of all, what's your main point that you're trying to say?
I was saying that the GWIS graph simplifies the, you know, the data.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much my main point.
It's like, what do you mean by simplifying the data?
Well, I mean, it can make it... It definitely does have... It has different tricks that it uses to manipulate the report.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just what I say. So, like, now in your opinion, do you think that, like, which of the methods that we just talked about, in your opinion, is the most effective to fool people with? Is it, like, the use of the word average, or is it the drawings, or is it something in the previous chapters we discussed, or just...
I mean, it could possibly be the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the pictures are more visible,
mm-hmm.
you know, with numbers. Someone has to, you know, want to look at the numbers, but pictures just kind of hard to avoid them.
Yeah.
Just a right dab on the page, you have to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you'll look at the picture, and then you'll see, like you were saying about from the cartoon, you'll see a graph that maybe it looks linear, but it may not be linear.
Yeah. And something I just want to point out that I find kind of a funny, you know, like, there are graphs that are actually 100% true. You know, say, for instance, you look at the school district affiliate website, and you find, you know, graphs of, like, you know, the SAT rate or Keystone's rate, you know, like, how well they did. And then they look at this book and say, it's a well put together graph, and I think it really sells the information well. It's obviously true. But it's a book called How to Lie with Statistics, and so I'm assuming that all these graphs are fake, and so that doesn't help anybody at all. You can't really tell the difference between what's real and what's fake. And yeah, so yeah, I think that's a good stopping point for this podcast. We will be here hopefully next week to talk about the last chapters of the book, and I'm totally ready to finish the book. What about you?
Yeah, me too. I think it should be a good ending.
Very good ending to a weird way to lie with statistics. All right, we will see you guys next week. All right, good morning, everybody. My name's Eamon Kelly.
My name is William Derry.
And we're going to be talking about the last few chapters of Daryl Huff's How to Lie with Statistics. So as of right now, we are done with the book. So, yeah, it's an exciting read. So, like, what were your initial thoughts of how the book ended?
I thought the book ending was great. I was excited for us to be finished and for it to come to an end.
Yeah, finally done reading this book. Now I can get some sleep.
Now I can get some sleep in. You know, of course, they ended the book with a photograph, a photo, a description, and I don't know, I liked how the last two chapters gave us descriptions on how to manipulate the readers, and then also in the last chapter, how to, you know, read between the lines of people trying to manipulate us.
So, like, do you have any examples of manipulating people?
Yeah, I know the author talked about profit on cost price, also showing a graph with a fixed y-axis. He also talked about showing the scale to show steep growth. But I guess what I'm trying to say here is he talked a lot about, you know, manipulating the data and showing false signs of increase or decrease.
Yeah, I did notice a few patterns in those last two chapters. I especially liked, you know, how the main focus of the last chapter was how to avoid statistical lies, which I thought was pretty interesting. Saying is the book is called How to Lie with Statistics, but the last chapter is How to Avoid It. And I think either they're changing the perspectives to be able to give the readers a chance to how to avoid these lies. I think it's also, you know, like the author is saying, okay, the first eight chapters, these are what they're doing to lie to you. Here's how you can tell that they're lying and how you can avoid it. So I think that... how they worded that last chapter was very cool. And I think it's also, like I said in the first podcast, I was a bit skeptical about how the book's structured, but the fact that they added this chapter made it really interesting. You know, like, this is what we're doing. Here's how you can avoid it. And also, it made me think, now that we're knowing all this information, I still think that, like, we should be able to tell everybody that you have the right to ask why. You know, if someone's lying to you using statistics, you can, like, well, why does that, how does that make sense, or why should I believe that? And then If they can't come up with anything else, they're obviously lying. And then, but yeah, that's basically my thought on those endings. Like, now, like, on a general term, like, were there any, like, moments in the book that you felt, you know, disturbed by, or you felt that you disagreed with the most?
Well, I don't want to say disagree, but, of course, I guess surprised by just the okay name he talked about in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
With the first question he says, so the first question is, who says so?
Okay.
And he talked about a study about something, but the point of it is they used the Cornell as the research lab, but really, even though they used Cornell as for the data or for backing, it was really the writer's opinion. So I feel like when you see that name, like Cornell University or some type of prestigious university or a prestigious person, that it really, you know, okay, this is definitely right. You don't, you're not going to say, oh man, maybe this isn't
like,
true.
Yeah. So Bill Gates said this, it must be true. Like, it's from Cornell University. That must be true.
Yeah.
Well, I've never even been to Cornell. I never even visited the campus. So I have no idea what they're talking about. So, but like, I know that Cornell is an Ivy League school. And so I would imagine that, yeah, if it's from an Ivy League, it must be right. But even though they're attacking Ivy League schools, I can't tell who's right and who's wrong.
And so, it's not so much that the Ivy League school is wrong. It's just like, okay, the Ivy League school is right, but how is the writer using the information they gave him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I think it relates to correlation, doesn't it?
A little bit.
Like, you said you had, like, some sort of, like, theory about correlation. You know, like, the fact that, like, you know, say, for example, like, you remember the John Oliver video we watched in class, or like, where we were talking about how two different factors doesn't make any sense when they're put together? Like, for example, I did my correlation project in my stats class about films that John Williams scored versus car crashes and how they relate to each other. And I think correlation is the most method I find intriguing. The fact that they can take two unnecessary factors and somehow tie them together using statistical analysis, and it can still sound right, in my opinion. I think that most of it is wrong, but like, yeah, it just intrigues me the most. That's what I'm saying. And also, you said smoking and bad grades, you said you had?
Yeah, I thought that the example he gave in Chapter 8, the chapter was post hoc rides again. And he talked about smoking being related to bad grades. But then the question he raised after that was, is it that the smoking was the cause of the bad grades? Or was it that the individuals who were getting the bad grades decided to take up smoking? So I feel like that underlying question is really important to think about when you're talking about this situation where people who are seeing if smoking is related to bad grades.
And now, let's take a moment. Now, try to imagine that you've never taken stats yet, and you've heard this smoking versus bad grades. If you were just a normal person on the city, not knowing anything about statistical analysis, would you believe them at first, or like, would you still have enough conscience to ask?
I think that I would be a little in between. Of course, you know, you don't want to think that are you for smoking and that leads to bad grades, but yeah, it would definitely be something that would, I guess, inspire thinking to something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, what he says is, one of the things is trying to deduce when the data wasn't available. So then you have to think about, okay, well, at one point they weren't smoking, so what were the grades like then?
Mm.
So I guess that would be something I would try to figure out was, okay, if these kids already had bad grades, the smoking's not affecting it. It's just on top. These are just kids who don't have good grades who are smoking.
Yeah.
So, and it could also be the other way where kids who are, you know, are smoking, that could lead to bad grades. But I don't think that I would try to – I think I'd be in the middle and try to figure it out. I wouldn't try to be a pro or con when seeing this.
Yeah, it does seem – like it does seem interesting, like, how they even get this idea. Like, you know, like, hey, let's take smoking and bad grades and somehow, take them together, and hopefully no one will question us. Like, they do understand that, like, there are lots of very good debaters in the world, lots of good people in the government that will obviously pinpoint errors and, like, well, how do you know this? And somehow they're still getting away with it. They're still, like, using this stuff to make them sound right. And I think Daryl Huffer is starting to save our lives right now by using this stuff. And also, I think that it relates to the first sentence in Chapter 7, like, which is, if you can't prove what you want to prove, demonstrate something else and pretend that they're the exact same thing. I think it's like, it sounds like he's saying that if you're having a hard time proving something else, take something completely different and somehow explain it the same way, and hopefully people will believe you. Like, for example, if you were trying to prove that, you know, let's say that if you were trying to prove, how, you know, trying to explain how the body works in it, and but the diagram you're using is not working, you know, talk about, you know, to, you know, talk about the sewer system, and then, like, it sounds similar the way it sounds right now, but, like, it's completely different, but then just explain it using drawings or cartoon shows, and then, like, people will believe you all of a sudden. I think, like, that's, you know what, this book is just making me more fascinated how dumb people are. like using statistics, you know, mimicking the kinds of lies we use in our daily lives. For example, I'm not talking about just using, like using mathematical analysis to prove a point. I'm talking about just simple lives that we use. You know, like, at 6:45, I was over here, and so that means I couldn't have been here. You know, like, it's like you're a detective, mm-hmm. and stuff, and you're solving, it's like solving a murder mystery. And it's like that. I think that this book doesn't necessarily just teach us how to lie with math. It tells us how these lies are similar to lies that all of us perform in our daily lives. Like, would you say so yourself?
Yeah, I would say so. What you're just saying. I think that the book opens up, I think it definitely creates conversation.
Yeah.
After reading this book, you're not going to think about stats or, I guess, people the same way.
Yeah.
Like you're saying about how dumb people are. It's amazing how stats can be used positively and negatively.
I was paraphrasing. I don't mean
that. No. I know you're
dumb. Yeah. I don't mean that we're all dumb. It just seems like we overlook things a lot in this world. We don't really take the time to, like, stop and look at it. For example, you know, it's like, you know, my father actually, when he goes to the art museum, he actually takes, you know, stops and looks at the paintings and, like, takes a look at how beautiful, you know, how beautiful it is and how much time the artist spent to work on it. You don't, but kids will probably just walk past it and try to find a food court. I just feel like this book doesn't, you know, is telling us that we need to take a few moments and take a look at what we're looking at and make sure it's right, and that will help us be better humans and be able to help us increase our observation skills and to help us make better conclusions based on what we see, rather than just skip forward and look for something more amazing. Yeah, I think that's the moral of this book that I think truly stands out to me. Of course, I just came up with it a few seconds ago. But what do you think are your final thoughts on this book?
Yeah, I think one major takeaway is just being more observant. You know, looking at a graph or looking at a stat or some type of set of data and just questioning it, even though it may have the backing of some type of big name, or if it's by some major corporation, or even if it's as simple, it's a simple study, you should still question it and see who's saying this. And you should say, well, does it make sense?
It doesn't make sense. And if it doesn't make sense, there's obviously something wrong, and then you should fix it.
Exactly. So you try to, you know, read between the lines, you try to get behind that data. You have to, you know, the first question he raises is, who says so? And then in that, you know, there's bias in who says so. So you have to understand that person's bias, and from there, hopefully you can better understand the data and, you know, not be misled.
Well, it depends on how known the person is, right? Like, you say it's a person that sounds familiar, but you don't really know who he is, and then unless he has a title under it, you know, like, you know, CEO of, I don't know, dog food, CEO of some major corporation, and if it says like that, then you'll believe him, even though you have no idea who this person is, which is really fascinating. All right, I think this should wrap up our definitely last podcast. Had a lot of fun. So hopefully we'll be able to do this in the future. You know, talk about more books, not for a while, but yeah. Had a lot of fun. Any final thoughts?
No, I had a great time. This is fun. I like this.
All right. Well, it's been great talking to you guys. I'm Eamon.
My name's Will.
And so thank you for joining us in How to Lie with Statistics. We will hopefully be back with more interesting reads.